This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's been less than a year since assault allegations against Harvey Weinstein came to light and fired up the Me Too movement. Since then, people have come forward with their experiences of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and bullying. Now, this has touched a number of industries: entertainment, domestic work, restaurants, hospitality, even public radio. These allegations have brought shame to these men, but now some of them are trying to get back into public life. Louis C.K. has done comedy sets. Writer and former radio host Gian Gomeshi wrote a cover story for the New York Review of Books. And former TV host Charlie Rose has considered interviewing other men who have been accused. Is all of this too much, too soon? What does a comeback look like? And given their behavior, why on earth should we care whether these men can bounce back? We'll get to that after you hear this.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Would you put on a sweater that once belonged to Hitler? Can Chinese zodiac signs predict who's going to be a great scientist? And what happens when you use a training method for dogs to teach doctors? Answers to all those questions on my podcast, Hidden Brain.
Joining us in studio is Celeste Headlee, the co-host of Scene on the Radio Season 3, Men, and author of the book We Need to Talk. Celeste has guest hosted this program as well. And previously, she co-hosted The Takeaway with John Hockenberry. In the interest of disclosure, 1A's senior leadership includes that program's former executive producer. Celeste, welcome back to 1A.
It's good to be here.
Also with us in studio is Monica Hesse, a columnist for The Washington Post and the author of Burn. Monica, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And at KUOW Public Radio in Seattle is Katie Herzog, a staff writer for the independent weekly paper, The Stranger. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let me work my way around through the three of you and just kind of get your sense of all of this, whether this kind of road to redemption thing seems justifiable, surprising, reprehensible. Monica Hesse, I know we got to pause shortly, but let me start with you. Your general gut check on all this.
Well, I think that when we talk about a road to redemption, we should be talking about it with a scalpel and not with a bludgeon, because there's a vast difference between Harvey Weinstein and Louis C.K. and Chris Hardwick. We're talking about variants and shades of gray. And for some of these men, I do think that there's a path to redemption. And for some of them, I think that they've foregone their right to be in the public eye in any case.
Celeste?
I don't think that many of the jobs these men had were not entitled to them. My reaction is that their redemption is their personal journey. It has nothing to do with the public. But if I hired a bank manager who then stole money, I would not put that person in charge of money again. So if some of these men have shown they abuse power when they have it, I would probably not put them back in power over other people again.
Katie?
Yeah, I agree with both Monica and Celeste. When someone has proven to be incompetent at their job or a toxic boss or a toxic force in the workplace, I don't think that we're under any obligation to give those people a position of the same prestige or the same job. That said, I also do think that, like Monica said, there's a lot of nuance between these cases, and we need to be careful not to sort of lump everybody under Harvey Weinstein.
Abby emailed, "As a survivor of sexual assault, I know all too well the effects of speaking out. I started speaking out against my abuser, an ex-boyfriend, 2 years before the Me Too movement really took off. Abusers can make a quote-unquote comeback when the survivors of their abuse are granted more access to opportunity, understanding, and advancement as they are. As a society, we have not moved ourselves to understand the trauma that survivors go through as much as we have tried to absolve the guilt of our abusers." Monica, what about Abby's comment? First of all, Abby, thank you for telling your story. Monica, how far have we come in terms of understanding what abuse victims are dealing with, holding abusers accountable? It would seem like we're making some progress.
I think that we're making delayed progress and slow progress. And even in the past week, we're seeing a little bit of progress. But I think that what's happening is that these issues have been buried under astroturf for so long that we're going to go through a period that feels like it's getting painful and feels like it's getting worse before it's getting better. And that's because women are finally able to talk about things that they weren't able to talk about for decades.
This week on the media from WNYC had a conversation about forgiveness. Here is a clip of that with Rabbi Danya Rutenberg. Listen.
The perpetrator knows if they've done real repentance. The victim has the choice about whether or not they want to forgive that person. And the literature says if your victim doesn't accept your apology right away, you have to apologize at least two more times. But we, the general public, are not here to adjudicate these cases. We don't owe these men fame. We don't owe these men fortune. We can choose to be generous and decide that we are willing to hear what they have to say in this case, but we don't owe them anything.
Rabbi Danya Rutenberg speaking on WNYC's On the Media. Celeste Headley, what do you make of what the rabbi said?
I agree with her. And, you know, it's interesting to me, especially in light of the past couple weeks since people have had a chance to read and digest Jean Gomeshi's piece and the 7,000-word cover story that John Hockenberry wrote for Harper's. There's a lot of angst and concern over what happens to these men. Why should they be unemployed? And it's been a matter of months. And there's not really a lot of examination of how many women have been impacted by that. And I want to be very specific about this because I don't want this to become a cliche. I want people to really think about the fact that I know in particular, John Hockenberry caused women to leave their jobs. He caused women to lose their jobs. He put huge roadblocks up in women's careers. So before we begin to talk about how to redeem him, not in his soul, but professionally, maybe we should talk about how to make good on what happened to these women who were victimized.
Can we get a little deeper on what happened, Celeste? I did want to give you a chance to talk from your perspective about what you experienced with John Hockenberry. You and he were co-hosts of The Takeaway at WNYC. He left that job, and then thereafter, stories about the treatment that went on behind the scenes came to light. Give us a sense of the kinds of treatment that you experienced from him.
Now, I want to be clear. I only was bullied.
Only
for
bullied.
Years.
Right.
Among other things. Not just bullied, but when I advanced up the chain of command, making my complaints official and going further and further through the chain, his defense to the HR department at WNYC was he got out of hand sometimes because I was so incompetent at my job. I was so bad that it caused him to behave badly. That was his defense. Eventually, not 2 months after I made that particular complaint to HR, I was let go. There's zero concern over how that kind of talk about me being incompetent might impact my ability to get a job in the future. But also, Suki Kim's excellent reporting that came out in December of last year, I think, also detailed the fact that there was sexual assault going on. There was sexual harassment going on, and that had been going on for years. It had been reported to the management at WNYC, and they had done nothing.
What did you make of seeing him published in Harper's?
I didn't read it. I lived it for 3 years. I don't need to read anything about it. But the excerpts that I saw, it's just a lot of angst on his part. I'm sure this has been difficult for him. It's not like John Hockenberry is a monster of a human being, right? I mean, we have to be careful in trying to understand why people do awful things in painting them to be monsters. He's human, and humans are capable of both wonderful and awful things. But do we need to read a 7,000-word story about him complaining about being unemployed and comparing himself to a 12-year-old rape victim when he compared himself to the character Lolita? No. No, thank you.
John wrote on our Facebook page, "We first need to give voice and respect to men who are victims so they can have their comebacks. It is shameful that male victims of sex crimes and domestic violence struggle to gain permission by police, mental health, social services, and even the courts to be treated as, respected as, and accepted as a victim." Tiffany wrote on our Facebook page, "There is no reason to have a way back. Prison. End of story." I believe she's referring to the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, Monica.
I think that what we need to keep in mind is that there is a vast chasm between going to prison for the rest of your life and being one of the most highly paid comedians or producers or journalists in the world. And with most of these cases, we are not saying you must live on bread and water for the rest of your life. What we're trying to explore is the idea that you have a right to be the most highly paid and respected comedian in the world. Many of these men could go and live fulfilling lives and not have to have public adoration and be on the television screen every time you turn it on or in your newspaper every time you open it up. And I think that we need to be really specific that it is not punishment to deny someone the right to be rich and famous.
But Katie, what about that? I mean, I don't know if, you know, Tiffany's response applies to everybody. I mean, I understand in a matter of criminal charges that that might be the way to go, but we are in a historic moment. I mean, this is the first time in human history that we're having this kind of discussion about the relationship between men and women in society. And we hear from a number of our listeners who are perfectly fine with using this as a moment for a bludgeon rather than a scalpel. Maybe some of the more thick-skulled men among us need to be hit in the head and reminded, like, no, you can't do this anymore, and we're going to make an example out of you so your buddies learn the lesson quickly. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that it's not effective. What we know from studies of sex offenders, and I'm not comparing John Hockenberry to a sex offender necessarily, but what we know from studies of sex offenders is that shame doesn't work. Public shame, cutting people off from the human tribe, isolating them, rejecting them, it makes people more likely to recommit their crimes because they have nothing to lose. It increases their anger. And so I think while the desire for revenge is completely understandable, and I'm very sympathetic to that, we need to decide if what we want is revenge or what we want is to stop the behavior, because we can't really do both.
Paul tweeted, as a Christian and a man who spent his teenage years as a violent punk rocker, I both believe in and am very grateful for the forgiveness and opportunities for redemption that I've been given. But forgiveness doesn't happen without contrition and demonstrated change. Lots and lots of comments about demonstrating change. Anne wrote on our Facebook page, these men who have been brought down by the Me Too movement do not deserve a second chance until they show that they understand what they did was wrong and have made some real effort to try to make their victims whole. Celeste, it feels like there's some kind of public penance that needs to be paid, at the very least, a genuine apology.
Yeah, and frankly, that was one of the things that irked me the most about John Hockenberry's piece in Harper's, because he had the gall to call his accusers cowards and said that none of them except one had reached out to him after his heartfelt queries. But let me go on record that say that I did not receive any heartfelt query or otherwise from John Hockenberry. I haven't heard from him since before I left the takeaway. If we're talking about change, then maybe before he writes a 7,000-word essay in Harper's, he needs to actually reach out to the people that accused him, not by calling them cowards in a magazine. And I have to assume that, you know, this is what Me Too is about, that what I'm saying right now might not also be heard and felt by other women who say, look, you know, before you make this plea for public forgiveness, why not ask for mine?
Monica Hesse, can you think of any examples of men genuinely seeking redemption that might fit these criteria that some of our listeners are describing? Or are we still kind of waiting for one of those?
The showrunner for Community.
Tell us about the showrunner.
Andy, and I've forgotten his last name. And
Dan Harmon,
thank you. I actually thought that his apology was incredibly heartfelt and took complete responsibility. And made no excuses, and actually he's already been working on trying to make amends. I think that's one of the few.
I would agree with that, and I think that what has been frustrating about some of the recent comebacks that we've seen, such as Louis C.K. coming on stage uninvited and then making jokes about rape whistles or about this lugubrious 7,000-word Harper's essay, is because they're not showing the same level of self-awareness that we saw from Dan Harmon. And the self-awareness goes a long way.
Katie Herzog, any others that you might think of, examples of how to demonstrate contrition in an acceptable or an effective way?
Well, there is a, and I'm going to, unfortunately, I'm going to butcher these people's name. There was a case over the past decade, a guy in Australia, his name was Tim Stranger, and he raped a woman as a teenager in Iceland when he was doing study abroad, and I can't remember her name, unfortunately. And then she lived with this pain. He also sort of felt lots of conflict and guilt when he realized what he had done. And over, you know, they went apart and lived their lives. And then when they were adults, she reached out to him. And they ended up having this decade-long correspondence. And they wrote a book together. They got together and practiced the principles of restorative justice. So he really took responsibility for his actions. But what that takes is, first of all, admitting your guilt. And the Gian Gomeshi piece, as well as the Hockenberry piece, from what I took from both of those was that neither of those men really believed that they're guilty. And so it's really hard to talk about redemption when you're not willing to, when you're not willing to admit that you've actually, done the thing that you're being punished for.
One of our listeners asked a question about what kind of, for a lack of a better word, might be considered restorative justice. Louise left this in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Louise, and regarding the men embroiled in the Me Too movement, I don't think anyone should be punished forever for a mistake or a crime. I'm in favor of ex-felons getting their voting rights back. So I think if they show genuine contrition and a willingness to change, then yes, they should be allowed to come back. Otherwise, let them rot.
Louise, thanks very much for calling in. Celeste, I do hear what Louise is saying, and also I take her point about, say, ex-felons. I mean, there are any number of major crimes that big figures have committed and found their way back. Part of me feels like this moment is just so visceral, and it's like the first chance for people who've done this in history, human history, to finally be held accountable, that it almost makes it easier, it almost makes it more acceptable, it almost makes it more likely that we would say, you know, throw him away. We've dealt with this for long enough. Bye. You're done.
Yeah, which is entirely not in my power. Like, it's useless to say that to me. I don't have any control over whether John Hockenberry or anyone else gets a job. He's free to take whatever job that he wants. I do want to point out, though, this isn't our first chance to hold people accountable. It's just the first time it might actually be happening. We've had lots of chances in the past. And what's important, and why the reason that even though I can't stand talking about those 3 years of my life, I keep doing it, is because there are lots of women out there who are not in a position to talk about this. What we're hoping is that by pointing out these more headline-grabbing stories, that this will change conditions for other women. It will make it easier and safer for them to report. It'll make it more likely that people will be held accountable. And most importantly, that management, the kind of management that winks at this kind of stuff, that oversees it, that does nothing when these reports come in, that eventually we get to the point where these managers and executives are held accountable as well.
Monica, what do you think some kind of a restorative justice might look like? What would that have to entail to be useful, to be effective, to be productive?
Well, what stands out to me in the example cited earlier about the rapist and his victim who achieved that, is that it was victim guided. It was her reaching out to him. And in John Hockenberry's essay, for example, when he mentions that being annoyed that women didn't respond to him, I just thought, well, why do you have any right to any more of their time?
Oh, I'm sorry. For those who haven't read the essay, clarify what he meant by that. Annoyed at women didn't respond to him. Clarify that.
So he was accused of harassment and misconduct by several women, and apparently, according to the essay, reached out to these women to want to correspond with them more and to want to rehash things. And I don't think that that is owed to anyone. I don't think that any victims should be forced to be the spirit guides for their perpetrator's redemption. I do think that what's honestly most important is not something that can be dealt with on a perpetrator by perpetrator basis. It's this broad interrogation of society that we're having right now. It's a broad interrogation of how we got here and what the norms are that we have allowed for centuries and how we can fix those. And that's restorative justice, not only for a man, but for the country, for the world.
I know we have to pause in just a moment, but Monica, just carry that a little bit further. I can imagine there's someone listening who says, hey, if if I have wronged you, at least give me a chance to make it right, especially if I realize that what I did was boneheaded and I just want to come, you know, with an olive branch. What's wrong, even with the victim saying, all right, I'm going to give you this chance? What's wrong with that?
I don't think that anything is wrong with that. But I think that if you are coming from a place of sincere apology and sincere grief, then writing a letter to your victim might be appropriate. What's not appropriate is that expecting that you will receive absolution or that you are owed it.
Max emailed, regular people have to face the consequences of our actions all the time. Getting fired does not mean that you should be blacklisted from working forever, but these men should face the same struggle that everyone feels after getting fired from a job. Should these men be able to get back into their previous industries, or should they have to move on for good? Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows. All with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Linda emailed, I thought Al Franken's mea culpa was genuine and heartfelt. I believe he is worthy of redemption. Katie, could you chime in on Al Franken? He did kind of push back a bit at being removed from the U.S. Senate, but he also seemed to acknowledge what he did.
Yeah, I think this is one of those cases where, you know, if I didn't like Al Franken's politics, I might not feel like he was, you know, ready for redemption. So I think that at least with these political figures, that is something that we all have to consider as well, is if this is somebody who you would want in office, you're probably more willing to forgive them. And I sort of understand how she feels about that. And I think in terms of the scale, what Al Franken is accused of having done is, you know, far less less terrible than what Harvey Weinstein or some of these other characters have done or have allegedly done.
I'm glad you brought up that scale because Mike emailed on that very thing. Mike writes, there are huge differences amongst these offenses. If they were graphed from never did anything to outright rape, the biggest blip would be way to the left, right about at Al Franken. Is it right that they all seem to be treated the same? Celeste?
Okay, they're not all treated the same. So I think you can go through each person one by one and see that they've had their investigation. There was an investigation at WNYC that confirmed the reports. There was a long investigation of John Gomeshi. They're not all treated the same. And I would also like to point out that trying to tell women that they need to learn the difference between rape and sexual harassment is only going to anger the women in your life. We know the difference. If you look at the statistics on how many women have been subject to either sexual assault or sexual harassment, you will begin to realize that even though, yes, there are men that also suffer from this, by and large, women are intimately aware of the difference between rape and sexual harassment, and we're not expecting everyone to, as we've mentioned, be bludgeoned with the same stick. We just want to make sure that we're safe in our workplaces. That's all.
Could we touch on the men who do suffer from this? Cam tweeted, there are men who are assaulted by other men and women as well, like Terry Crews. However, it's common to ignore this or look down on them for being assaulted, let alone reporting it. We need to let people know there are male victims who are ridiculed for having a voice. Monica Hesse, I gotta say, the more I hear Terry Crews tell his story, the more impressed I am. I already liked him, but just his willingness to just say it, to just tell what happened is pretty incredible.
I mean, who doesn't love Terry Crews?
Right.
First of all, who among us doesn't love Terry Crews?
Well, especially because he's this like big, strong, strapping dude who is willing to talk about being victimized, which is just not
right.
A very manly man thing to do.
Right. I think that what this gets back to is what is a common misconception that's arisen in Me Too, which is that this is about a bunch of women out to get individual men. And And that's not what it's about, or it's not what it should be about. What it is reckoning with a culture that has let powerful men do terrible things to women and sometimes to other men, or that has considered victims to be weak or to be expected to behave in certain ways, when we know that victimology is complicated and people like Terry Crews might sit on something for years before they feel comfortable enough to come forward. So I think that when we talk about male victims, A, we should talk about male victims, but we should also talk about a system in which all victims feel more supported to come forward, and we have a better understanding of what harassment looks like in a bunch of different ways.
Michael tweeted, "Why is there no discussion about management? The bosses aren't doing their jobs yet by focusing on the stars. That's especially true in public media." Celeste, I know you chimed in on this just a second ago with regards to WNYC. Katie Herzog, I wonder what you would add to that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, we know that the problem here is these power structures, in part, these systems that let men or women and, you know, much smaller cases get away with these sort of things. But we still want to, you know, sort of exact these individual punishments while reforming the system. And I'm not sure how compatible those two are. But I think, yeah, I think management, I think systems of power hierarchies that enable this behavior to continue, or this is what we should be looking at.
I wonder, Celeste, if, with regards to management, if this is kind of peeling the veneer off of certain industries in terms of the way that the rubber meets the road or the economic incentives. I mean, you look at someone like, say, Les Moonves, who was formerly the chairman, right, formerly the chairman and CEO of CBS Corporation, and Les Moonves was accused of some pretty awful things in an array of reports by The New Yorker. When the second one came out, CBS's board of directors voted to get him out of the company. But Les Moonves was also leading CBS's fight not to be reabsorbed by Viacom. CBS is doing really well economically. Viacom is in real trouble, and Viacom wanted to re-ingest CBS to save itself. It feels to me like the economics are also almost a bigger factor than the ethics in some cases, where if we have a financial reason not to let you go, we better be really, really sure that we're going to let you go.
Well, look, this is all about abuse of power, right? It doesn't matter where along the chain you look. What we're talking about is abusing your power. And in these particular cases, to my mind, until you actually get to that executive level, the executives that know what's going on and then choose whatever it may be, their reputation, their bottom line, some of them, you have to wonder if it's economic because they paid fantastic sums of money and settlements and other things in order to keep some of these men on the job. But until the solution for an executive who finds out that their sexual harassment or assault going on by one of their staff members, until all they have to do is wait for the Washington Post to write about it and then fire that person and then they're safe, none of this will change. I mean, as long as that's all you have to do, nothing changes.
Monica, does this change the way that we go forward? Does this mean that the conversation needs to focus on people at the top? I mean, if it was Les Moonves, the CBS intern, who had been acting creepily toward women, you know what I'm saying? Like, and it would have been easy to bounce him.
I think that there's a reason why these conversations have focused on industries like the media and politics and journalism. It is not because harassment does not happen in the food service industry or at Burger King or at the bowling alley or any place where people are employed. We're having these conversations because people in journalism and media and politics are the people who are shaping our world. They are the people who are creating what we consider to be culturally normal. They are creating the laws that we all have to live by. And so it is important to focus energies there in some ways, because that's what helps change the culture when we're saying men who shape the culture can't shape a bad culture.
These are also people who make a lot of money, seven, eight figures a year, depending on what they do. And I wonder, Katie, how much just the economics of that plays into it. Les Moonves was making $70 or $80 million a year flat salary working as the head of CBS Corporation. One of our listeners wrote on our website, the1a.org, "I'd be fine with leaving the Weinstein types in permanent exile. They can afford it. I'd be more curious about what to do with not wealthy men who get accused of being predators with enough evidence to be fired but not enough to get jailed. Did they just get jobs somewhere else, like priests to new parishes? Women would still be vulnerable, but if they can't work, then what? Petty crime? I don't see any good path forward. Katie?
Yeah, it's complex. I think that's a really good point, especially, you know, as Celeste mentioned, these things don't just happen in these sort of prestigious fields. They happen all over. At this point, or last week, McDonald's workers across the U.S. were striking against sexual harassment. These things, as much as they happen in public radio, they're happening at the local Waffle House. And when people who are punished who don't have large resources, also we have to realize that this could impact their families. And so sort of the hurt spreads out from the center of the crime there. And so I think that's a really good point, though, that, these industries have a financial impetus to protect these people. But if you're, a manager at a McDonald's or whatever, you're probably not going to be protected.
Celeste?
I want to add one more sort of nuance to why we're hearing all about this from TV and radio and movies, right? One of the reasons I'm able to talk about this so freely is because I don't have to worry about people giving me a job now. I'm at the position now at 48 years old where I'm my own boss. That's taken a really long time. And it was only in 2012 that I was actually for the first time paid the same amount as a male in my exact same field. So I'm able to talk about this because I'm safe. A woman who's working the French fry machine at McDonald's is not safe.
Right.
And even now, me talking right now, I still run the risk of people saying they don't want to work with me because they think I'm shrill and angry and hard to work with. That's the danger I run as a female bringing these concerns up. I'm still worried about that, even though I basically work for myself.
How far away, Celeste, do you think we are from that worry being able to be lessened or be negated? To not face backlash for speaking something that needs to be said.
Considering the fact that those unconscious biases exist in both men and women of almost all ages, we're a ways away.
Got a number of comments about the potential for false accusations to have an impact. Mike emailed, I have been falsely accused of sexual harassment twice in my life. Both times the investigation found the allegations were completely false. I know I'm an outlier and that most accusations of misconduct, rape, and harassment are completely true, but we should be a society based on proven truths and not just accusations. Taylor wrote on our Facebook page about the matter of Louis C.K. Taylor writes, Louis didn't do anything wrong. Ironically, he got in trouble for what he was trying to avoid. His masturbation fetish was to prevent false allegations of assault. Rich guys have it tough. Women throw themselves at you, but have incentive to stab you in the back. Monica?
I'm speechless. I think that... I think that what this email says to me that makes me really sad is how deeply enculturated we are to believe that a lot of this is okay or a lot of this is normal. It's the phrase that we're seeing come out a lot this week in the wake of Judge Kavanaugh's allegations. Boys will be boys. All men.
Horseplay.
Horseplay. All teenagers try to do this, or all men try to masturbate in front of women. This isn't normal. If it's happened,
I hope I don't have to be the man who tells people no. We really, that's just not
right.
No.
It's most men don't do this.
No, we don't. No.
And if it's happened to you, it's okay to wrestle with the fact that was bad. Something bad happened to you.
Although I do kind of, Katie, I do hear some of what they're getting at. This need for a sense of equal justice, so that women are presumed to be telling the truth, but that there's still a way to kind of withhold judgment until their story is corroborated, confirmed. So there's some kind of a process.
Yeah,
Katie,
but in that message from your listener, sorry, I forgot his name. He said there was an investigation and he was shown to be blameless. So
Mike.
That seems to, like, the system worked for him.
Worked for Mike. Katie, I think Taylor is concerned about the system perhaps not working for Louis C.K. or the potential for men in positions of wealth and status and power to be targeted, to be kind of preyed upon by women who may be able to cry wolf.
Yeah, I would never defend someone's right to non-consensually masturbate in front of their colleagues. I think she's a little off base on that. In terms of the other comment, Mike, I think there's a little bit more validity to that. But, you know, Celeste just mentioned he was investigated, and I'm going to use the term exonerated. That's probably not correct. But then again, so is Gian Gomeshi. There was a trial. He was found not guilty. And he wrote this piece, and there's this huge outcry. So it's not like you can go through the criminal justice system, come out the other side, and then everything is forgiven. And I'm not sure that it should be that way.
I know that we have to wind down, but I wonder what your sense is of where this puts us in the broader Me Too movement. I mean, it feels like almost act two of the story. Act one was the ability to have the Harvey Weinsteins get booted out. Act two is kind of, you know, the Empire Strikes Back in a way. It's kind of the pushback and saying, well, wait a minute, I've paid my penance. It's time for me to get back to work. What does act three look like? I think. Celeste?
Ideally, Act 3 would be there is no month-long amount of time you have to serve before you're allowed to be put in a position of power over people that you've victimized in the past. Go get a job. No one's preventing any of these men from just getting a regular job. But frankly, I want to say that we have had this moment before. If you look back through the decades before, you would be shocked at how similar the conversations were that occurred in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and then early 2000s. What we have to do is make sure that this time it sticks.
Monica, where does this go from here?
I actually think that one of the bigger mistakes we can make right now is to be rushing us to go anywhere immediately. I think that it is confusing. I think we are all confused. I think we are all struggling, and a lot of us are in pain. And I think that it is okay and probably healthy to wallow in that discomfort for a while. It's necessary for us to really have difficult, horrible conversations about this rather than just figuring out how to tie everything up in a bow.
And Katie, before we go?
Yeah, I'm not sure where we're going to go from this, but I do think that everything that's happened in the past year with Me Too has certainly conveyed a message to both men and women that this behavior will not be tolerated. So I'm not sure, you know, what the future holds for John Hockenberry or anybody who's been actively accused, but I do think that hopefully men will learn some lessons about how to act and how not to act in the workplace.
Katie Herzog, a staff writer for The Stranger. Katie, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Monica Hesse, columnist for The Washington Post and the author of The War Outside, which comes out tomorrow. Monica, thank you.
Thank you.
And Celeste Headlee, co-host of Scene on the Radio Season 3 and the author of We Need to Talk. Thanks, Celeste.
Thanks, Joshua.
Remember, you can connect with us via text message. Text 1A to 63735 to join our network. Again, 1A, the number 1, the letter A, to 63735. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.